Next up on This Week in Law, we've got two very big thinkers with us, Jerry Brito and Marvin Amori. We're going to talk a lot about legislation and policy issues, including DARPA wanting to share some government spectrum, what's going on with phone unlocking bills, CFAA and DMCA reform. We'll talk about printing guns and gun parts. And is anyone up for litigation? We've got all that and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 202, recorded March 15th, 2013. Yo Quiero Taco Drone. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWiL. And by LegalZoom. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your direction, such as affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TWiL to receive $10 off at checkout. Hi, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and we've got such an incredibly bright panel with us today. I'm thinking you better wear your shades. There you go. Happy St. Patrick's Day this weekend to all. And whatever sunglasses you have handy, put them on now because we've got two very smart folks joining us today. We've got Jerry Brito of the Surprisingly Free podcast and general man about the internet. Hello, Jerry.
Hello. How's it going?
It's going really well. Thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Marvin Amori, who has written a book recently called On Internet Freedom. Hello, Marvin.
Hello, Denise. It's good to be on.
It's great to have you on. And joining us, too, from Chicago, both Marvin and Jerry are in the Washington, D.C. area. So we're going to talk a lot about policy, politics, bills, legislation, regulation, things like that today on the show, among other things. But before we jump into all of that, we're going to say hello to Chicago, Illinois, and Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. How's it going? It's fun to be hanging out with you. I hope you're off to a good start, you know, celebrating the St. Patrick's Day weekend should be fun.
Yes, it should be. It's always fun when the leprechauns show up. All right, so let's go to Washington, D.C., where they have their own share of mischievous leprechauns and talk policy first off. All right, Marvin, you have been writing a lot lately about disruptive transportation startups such as Uber and Lyft and Sidecar, and why they're having a tough time getting off the ground, as it were. I think mostly they want to stay on the ground, but taxi regulations are coming into play, and several cities want to ban these kinds of services. First of all, for anyone who has never come into contact with Uber or Lyft or Sidecar, can you tell me what they're doing that's different?
So Uber is a technology platform. From the user's perspective, you push a button pretty much on your app and a black car shows up a few minutes later. You jump in, it takes you where you want to go, and you get out and it's automatically paid through the credit card on your account. Total no hassle, very classy ride. So I really love Uber. And it's very popular. It raised $50 million. It's been launched in cities around the world, from San Francisco to Paris and in Washington, D.C. Companies like Lyft and Sidecar are a little different, but they're also technology platforms. They would let you determine that I'm driving down the street and my car could be a good bus route for you to take in the morning. And so you could then tip me afterward and you'd catch a ride from me, not from a chauffeur or limo driver.
So it's sort of a brokered hitchhiking kind of situation.
Kind of. It's like Airbnb for cars or it's sort of peer-to-peer travel.
It does all sort of cross the boundary between public transportation or privately available public transportation and a rental kind of situation, doesn't it? That you're more like renting a car temporarily or renting a ride?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you probably have a range of options when you want to get across town. You could drive your own car, you could jump into a bus, you could try a taxi. Now there are new options.
And is sidecar like Lyft?
Sidecar is just like Lyft, very similar.
Okay. So in several cities, this is not flying vis-a-vis the taxi regulations they have in place. Why is that?
Well, so traditionally, you would need some government oversight to make sure that people have some faith in the taxi system. When I was in Austin this week, I was at South by Southwest, and it was hard to get a cab. And one night, some stranger just drove up in a car and said, "Hey, I'm not a cabbie, but I need the money. Jump in." So I didn't jump in. Right? Before we had Uber and Lyft and Sidecar, it would be hard to trust the person who's going to give you a ride. And in addition, you needed a reliable transportation system to make sure, you know, grandma could get home from the store. And traditionally, there's been an entire edifice in every city to make sure that taxi cabs would be regulated. And often when there is a commission set up to regulate something, like the Taxi Commission or the Federal Communications Commission, the regulators end up protecting the industry that they're supposed to be regulating. So in a lot of cities, you have a real restriction in the number of taxi cabs, and you have prices that are higher than should be paid. You have less supply to meet the demand. And what ended up happening, I think, here is the taxi commissions have two impulses. One, these cities want to regulate these new ways of getting around the city. And two, they also seem to be in bed with the taxi companies themselves and attempting to block new competition to the taxi companies that exist.
So the FTC is our federal government arm that deals with competition and making sure that it exists. What are its plans with regard to this situation?
So it's unclear what the FTC will do. Before last week, no one even thought of the FTC as a major player. What had been going on for months was that city by city and state by state, you would see these really weird laws or interpretations of laws saying Uber can't operate because they have to charge a minimum price of $80 as a limo, or they can't pick you up within 5 minutes. They have to wait 24 hours through a booking service. All these weird laws really across the country in lots of different cities and states. And Uber and these other companies had gone through and fought every city commission by commission on the home turf of the taxi companies themselves. And I wrote an article in Slate that I think came out this week arguing that the FTC should be involved because the FTC, which, as you said, enforces the federal laws against anti-competitive action, the FTC for 20 years has been watching the taxi industry and has even brought suit against cities back in the 80s. And unbeknownst to me, when I wrote the article, the FTC was planning on filing a document in Colorado, which it filed on Thursday, arguing that Colorado's proposed laws, which would be really burdensome, would say that Uber would have to have minimum prices and none of these companies could park within, I think, 20 meters of a bar, all these weird, really weird anti-competitive rules. The FTC filed a document saying, you know, these are bad for competition, and if you need to adopt rules that are good, you know, for health and safety, then you should make sure that they don't also burden competition and new innovative ways to get around the cities. So it's a really great development.
Yeah, that is a great development. Jerry, it's really counterintuitive for folks, I think, to imagine that if they, you know, they own their car, they own their time, if they want to make an arrangement where they get paid for giving someone a ride, I think that, you know, most people would not think that the government would have any involvement in that whatsoever. I have a friend who had a son who just got his license last summer, and very enterprising because he could not drive around friends in California. Once you've gotten your license, you have to drive around people above a certain age until you're a bit older. So instead of driving around his friends, he decided, I'm going to drive around my parents' friends. You know, when they go out, if they need a ride, they can call me and they can, I'll give them a ride home. We'll make sure their car gets home and I'll make a little money on the side. Sounds like that kind of free enterprising spirit.
Illegal.
Yeah, probably illegal. So what do you think is the future of this situation? Do you think that the FTC is going to be able to work this out, or are we going to be in an awkward stage where companies like Uber and Lyft and Sidecar are randomly shut down in certain areas?
I'm optimistic simply because this technology is so cool. And if you've ever been in an Uber car, it beats the pants off a taxi, that I think once citizens get to understand what they're missing out on, they're not going to stand for it. And I think Marvin's right that you might want some base regulation as far as health and safety to make sure that the taxi driver has a background check and make sure that it's a car that's safe. But beyond that, when you have rules that have a minimum price, or say that there are certain things you can't do, you can't pick up people within a certain amount of time before they call you, that does nothing but restrict competition. I'm sympathetic to the FTC getting involved here and filing in these proceedings. I think where you might get some pushback, and Marvin, in your piece, you mentioned how conservatives and liberals would agree on this. Conservatives would agree that this is, would be limiting government. I think where you might get some pushback is this is a really local issue, right? This is a city making a decision about how it's going to be regulating its cars within its borders. Very, very, very local issue. And, here would be the federal government coming in, telling these cities how to run, their government business. Again, I'm sympathetic to FTC involvement, but I think that's some of the pushback or some of the argument you might hear on the other side for that.
Evan, would you like to see some sort of licensing requirements put on these kinds of businesses so that when someone picks you up in the Uber car, you know that they, have met some kind of limited competency for driving people around?
Oh, I think that might be a decent idea. Mm-hmm. it's ingrained in our psychological makeup to be concerned about our personal safety. And there's certainly in large metropolitan areas, there's probably a presumption of mistrust against everyone else that you're dealing with. So yeah, I think that's a pretty fundamental starting point, that there needs to be some kind of licensing going on here. But what I see is the critical question here, and I'm seeing this at probably a pretty simplistic level, certainly relative to the nuanced and granular view that Marvin is taking on it and the observations that Jerry is making here. We can't let that need for licensing and the assurance of public safety and making sure that grandma gets home from the store safe go so far as to it being a paternalism, where it really is the government that's getting in there. And the government, whether you look at the issue that Jerry is raising, saying this really isn't a federal government issue, or even if you're just talking about the local government, the mayor's office and whatever, getting involved with this, we don't want it to get so far where it really is there's no room for competition whatsoever, and that these disruptive technologies, that's really the story here, isn't it? This is a law and technology show. It's the technology that's what's made this so disruptive. And if there's so much of a licensing requirement that it becomes paternalistic, then there is no room for that disruption to take place. And that's not what any of us want to see, because we are also enthusiastic about seeing an environment where technology can indeed be disruptive, give rise to new business models. And we want an environment where that can actually happen, and it to happen at the appropriate pace, not too fast, not too slow, but in a way that the public interest and innovation, the balance is appropriately struck between those things.
Right. That's what one of the things Marvin points out in his article is that the FTC has commented that telecommunications advances might be what ultimately, disrupts the taxi industry. Marvin, do you think how do you think the licensing of all of this should work?
So I'm not totally sure we need a very rigorous limit on the licenses, just to begin there. One of the problems with the taxi commissions as they're structured is that there's a limit on how many medallions there might be. And I think that's a real problem. If you're just simply trying to get at health and safety, which is a really important concern that cities should be involved in, all you need to do is hand out as many licenses as needed. The same way that a restaurant could be licensed, you don't have a limit on the number of restaurants to make sure that they're all, you know, as healthy as they can be, right? You can have licenses. And everyone who's part of Lyft or Sidecar, to my knowledge, gets a background check. You have to have a background check in order for you to get a ride from me. So I think that we could focus on simply ensuring safety without limiting the number of drivers. But and when you look at the laws that some of these cities have tried to implement, they clearly look anti-competitive. They don't look like they're aimed at health or safety. There's not even a legitimate argument that a minimum price will keep us safer. Right? And one of the sort of broader question that all of us have sort of hit on is nowadays through technology, there are lots of ways for us to share things that we couldn't share before. You were saying, you know, it'd be weird if I couldn't charge someone to get a ride with me. You know, think of Airbnb. Someone wants to stay at your house and throw a few bucks your way, right? To you, that seems natural, right? We can do that through technology. People call this the sharing economy, things like Lyft, Airbnb. But there have been some controversies in New York City, for example, around whether or not people should be considered a hotel. And the hotel lobby has gone after Airbnb. And so we'll see with these sort of disruptive ways for us to share different, to share our own goods and to use new technologies, is you'll see incumbent industries using the force of city governments or other governments to try to stifle innovation. And just one final point is, Jerry and I tend to be on the opposite sides of the spectrum, so it's good to see us both agreeing that, in part, we could see less government in this space.
And can I say something about licensing?
Please.
I think when you have the restrictive licensing that, you know, that keeps entry out, you tend to make safety and health worse. Because since you're protected, you really don't have an incentive to have the safest car, the cleanest car, et cetera. And if you've been to DC and used Uber here, which is the only city I've used it, it's night and day between a taxi cab and an Uber car. And I think Uber, because they're competing, puts so much more emphasis on a clean, nice experience. And it's interesting, you know, with the technology, when you finish your ride, you're asked to rate the driver. And also the driver rates you as a passenger. And so this creates incentives on both sides to make sure that the experience is top notch. And if you're a bad customer, when a driver gets a call, you place a call for a car and he might be nearby, he can see, oh, this is a 2-star passenger. I'm not going to pick him up. And the same way, if a driver is low rated, I'm sure that Uber handles that. So it's not through licensing. It's just through this mechanism of feedback and competition.
I think it would really be hard to overstate the importance of that mechanism whereby the driver can rate the passenger. Because I was just having a little conversation here in IRC, and you know, my observation was I think that the taxi drivers have a more to be concerned about from unruly passengers than what the public does, you know, from unruly taxi drivers. That's a very interesting. It's kind of like the eBay or feedback mechanism, buyer and seller, which is right. A really kind of interesting concept in all of this.
Right. Yes. It's a virtual way for the taxi driver to just drive on by you without stopping.
And it allows you to have licensing that is sort of limited to just a baseline sort of safety inspection.
Yeah.
I as far as the safety of the driving situation goes, I'm just not sure. You know, I've been in plenty of taxis where I felt like my life was pretty much on the line based on the driving. So I'm not sure that their structure is really working well in that regard either. And we already have, you know, driving safety requirements in every state. You have to pass them in order to drive a car. So I'm not sure what else you would tack on to someone's license to enable them to participate in this kind of an arrangement, but I'm sure there could be something like, you know, a motorcycle license addition to one's license that would enable them. Any other thoughts on this before we move on, Evan?
No, it's just really interesting. And again, my interest in seeing how what the role that technology plays in all this. And it's fascinating to see how that, you know, kind of wedges its way into, you know, that whole dynamic between old incumbent sort of government regulation and, you know, the public interest and the things that the consumers want. It's really interesting how that's playing out.
Marvin, what is the, I'm spacing on the name of the transportation company where you actually pick up a car and then drop it off somewhere else?
And I think that's Zipcar.
Zipcar, yes. Is that impacted by the taxi rules as well?
I don't think Zipcar has been impacted at all. I think it was always seen as a rental car company, and it was even purchased by one of the larger rental companies. And you don't have a driver. You're not sending for a driver. So I feel as though Uber felt closer to a cab than a rental car because you have a separate driver.
Okay.
One interesting thing about Uber, we from our perspective as users, we're like, wow, this is a clean ride. You know, the driver's not on the phone the whole time. He's not smoking or, he's polite or she's polite. But what they actually do, one of the key innovations is, you know, if you call a cab, you know, you often get a response, you know, in 15 or 20 minutes or half an hour, we'll see if we can get you someone out there. Right? What Uber does is it sends us amazing mathematicians, I guess, who figure out these algorithms to get cars to you as quickly as possible. And that's something that we hadn't really seen from the monopoly regulated taxi industry. And so I think one of the key innovations we've seen through competition and what Uber actually does is figure out how to get cars to you as quickly as possible. And so I think there'll be great advances, and it would be great if the FTC sort of fosters the competition that has really made these advances possible so far.
Jerry, anything else on this?
Nope. I think we're all agreed. we need to allow Uber to compete.
All right.
Denise, one thing, IRC user iPad 18881 points out that really this is all going to be solved by autonomous vehicles someday. So this is just a kind of a temporary dispute that we need to be, or, you know, issue that we need to be deliberating, I guess.
But you can imagine taxi cab drivers are going to really be lobbying against allowing autonomous vehicles on the roads. Because that's not just competition. That's going to put him out of a job altogether. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an existential threat.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're legal in at least two states. Yeah. California, Nevada. I'm not sure where else. But yes, I have no idea what sort of licensing you need to go through to have one of those cars. All right. Well, that's a topic for another show. On our last episode of This Week in Law, we had Derek Khanna on. He's been very active in the cell phone unlocking arena. So we talked a lot about that next week. And in a moment here, we're going to talk about some legislation pending in both the House and Congress along those lines. But first, we're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile. When you're not zipping around in your zip car or having Uber take you across town, of course, what you're doing is you're sending things to people, mostly in the form of email. And when you're doing that, you're doing it as an attachment. You've got documents and spreadsheets, PowerPoints, contracts, all things that can get very large in size. And you need that information to be received, to get into the right hands and remain confidential. But it doesn't always. That's why ShareFile is important to every business. ShareFile by Citrix sends your attachments as secure links, so you can send files of almost any size with the highest degree of security and receive notifications when your files have been opened and by who. So when you go and have sensitive legal documents like we do in the legal profession or accounting documents, really in any profession, you're going to have things that you need to make sure have gotten there securely, that there's no issue with whether they've been received or not. You can understand exactly when the person who has received it has opened and read the document, what they've done with it. That's when you need ShareFile. It's easy to use. It integrates into any business. Plus, with ShareFile, you can access files from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, or smartphone. So it's a great remote access tool as well. I highly recommend ShareFile. If you're not using ShareFile yet, you need to sign up for our free trial now with no credit card required and nothing to lose. You'll see why millions of professionals rely on it every day. So get started today with our free 30-day trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com, and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. So we've got a bill pending in the House and one in the Senate, both in reaction to the move in January to rescind the exemption for cell phone unlocking. The Librarian of Congress did away with the exemption that had been in place for 3 years. The Senate bill wants to rescind the rescission, as it were, wants to undo that act and give us 3 more years of being able to unlock cell phones, at which time, who knows what would happen. The House bill wants to do a, it's sort of a surgical strike where unlocking would be made permissible, but the DMCA is left alone. Marvin, do you think either of these is going to do the job sufficiently?
I don't. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism about both of these attempts. And there was a third bill introduced by Senator Klobuchar and others authorizing the FCC to take some action, the Federal Communications Commission. And none of these bills have gotten a lot of kudos from those who are pushing for cell phone unlocking. I think they're all a good initial step, or as someone said on Twitter, jumping up in place. And they send a signal that Congress has heard that the public cares, but they're not going to really rock the boat too much. I mean, what they need to do as a sort of principled matter is simply go back to the DMCA itself and ask whether or not the anti-circumvention language in the law should be there, or adopt a permanent exemption for cell phone unlocking. That would probably make the folks who are fighting for cell phone unlocking happier. But a simple three-year fix or telling an agency to do what it already said it was going to do, those are simply sort of political gestures that doesn't really matter if they pass or not.
So, Jerry, if you were a Vegas odds maker, how would you set the odds on doing what Marvin suggested needs to be done, going back and reviewing all the anti-circumvention provisions and possibly doing away with some in the DMCA?
Well, again, to be optimistic, I think they're better than they've ever been, at least in the recent past, simply because Congress is getting the message that folks care about this, at least in the context of cell phone unlocking. And I think that's part of the issue, is that we've been talking very narrowly about cell phone unlocking, but this is about the DMCA, Section 1201, anti-circumvention prohibitions widely. It's not just about unlocking your cell phone. It's about unlocking your e-book readers, about unlocking your printer, about unlocking anything that you have so you can use it however you want, as long as you're not violating any contract that you may have with a provider. I think none of these bills really get at that. Certainly Senator Leahy's bill, and by the way, Senator Leahy is the author of the DMCA. He's a supporter of SOPA. The bill is co-sponsored with Al Franken, another SOPA supporter. Does almost nothing, right? It simply changes the rule that the Librarian of Congress put forth recently. But again, we're back to square one in 3 years, and probably possibly even before that. Senator Klobuchar's bill, again, takes something that is really a copyright issue. This is a DMCA issue, and then tells the FCC to require cell phone carriers to allow or to force them to force cell phone carriers to unlock phones. But that doesn't get at the issue of the DMCA. It doesn't get at the issue of somebody who might want to have the unlocking done by a third party. And then finally, Senator Wyden's bill, is the best of the bunch, but it does is provides a very narrow exemption, again, just for cell phone unlocking. And it should be broader.
Evan, any thoughts on the pending solutions to or responses mm-hmm. to the January decision by the Librarian of Congress?
Right. I hear the what Jerry and Marvin are saying about this being, you know, a short-term solution. If we were to just take that one bill that pertains just to the Librarian of Congress's action on this, rather than going and amending the DMCA in a way that is purportedly positive if you're against the restriction that 1201 imposes on cell phone unlocking. But I see the benefits of not messing with the DMCA on this particular point, because I just think it's a good practice to not make statutes written to be so technologically specific. You know, if we're going to amend the DMCA to say something in Section 1201 that says, oh, and all this stuff about anti-circumvention doesn't apply to this particular form of technology, I just think that that opens us up to problems in the future as new technologies emerge. And, you know, yeah, sure, smartphones are a panacea right now. But, you know, 5-10 years from now, who knows what really the concern du jour is going to be. So I would like to see a more probably fundamental revisiting of circumvention prohibitions and have it done in a way that is you know, more technologically agnostic. And so for that reason, it would perhaps paradoxically be a good idea at this point just to deal with the particular actions, or if you want to look at it in a certain way, the inaction of the Librarian of Congress, just so that we are only messing with this particular issue, with this particular technology. Give us more time to figure out how market forces and consumer sentiment and the business interests really inform us in ways that we should guide us in ways that we should handle the whole question of circumvention liability in Section 1201 and Section 1202 in general.
Well, there are some parallel issues here when we're talking about anti-circumvention provisions and whether or not they're to be complied with, and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, right? Because what you might be doing is brushing up against the law if you are undoing the copy protection on a DVD, if you are taking the DRM off of an ebook, if you are unlocking or jailbreaking a phone. It's all kind of, you know, what can I do with this technology? Or if you're investigating security issues with any kind of technology, you may be doing, all of those may have both positive and potentially negative ramifications depending on your intentions. But, you know, do you want to throw out the baby with the bathwater? Do you want to quash the impulse to go in and mess around a bit? Trevor Tim, who was on with us last week, has a good article about this over at EFF, saying that if we don't reform the CFAA, we might stop the next Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, or Mark Zuckerberg. And he goes and recounts some anecdotes about the youthful moves of those folks, Woz and Steve Jobs with their Blue Box and Captain Crunch and doing a bit of phone freaking. Mark Zuckerberg hacking the Harvard network, but not getting prosecuted for it. And Bill Gates and Paul Allen trying to get free time on some time-sharing computer and getting slapped on the wrist for that. You know, they obviously were able to go on and do great things after these episodes and with the CFAA in the condition it is now. And in parallel with the DMCA, preventing under the law a number of similar kinds of actions, we're kind of in a quandary. What do you think, Jerry?
Well, I think there's two things about any law, any criminal law, but you could definitely apply this to the CFAA, is number one, whatever punishment you have should be proportional to the crime. And so, you know, something like what was happening with Aaron Swartz, where, you know, he was, you know, quote unquote, breaking into what was a very open network. Once he was discovered, you know, everybody involved except the federal prosecutors wanted to simply let him off with a warning. But no, the CFAA and the prosecution that was allowed under that would throw the book at him. And I think if the punishment would have been a lot less, he might have been able to accept that punishment or had a better outcome than, of course, what happened. And then the other thing is that the CFAA allows, it's still a little bit debatable, but the CFAA potentially allows violation of a contract. So say the fact that you breach a website's or a system's terms of use, allows that to be the predicate for criminal prosecution. And that's just wrong. That is an agreement that you have between yourself and the website, between you and whatever other system. And that should, you know, any breach of that should be handled through contract law. There's got to be some other predicate for a criminal prosecution.
Evan, in his article, Trevor envisions a law that is both even-handed and nuanced. He writes, the CFAA can and should reach serious computer intrusions that cause real damage, as should related laws criminalizing identity theft, stealing trade secrets, or engaging in massive fraud. But the law needs to recognize the difference between commercial criminals and those who are merely testing the boundaries or engaging in youthful indiscretion. Right now, it hands prosecutors the same sledgehammer regardless. Do you think that the law could be tailored in the way that Trevor envisions?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? I mean, who among us can disagree with the sentiments that are in that? And, you know, Trevor is brilliant in his way of articulating, you know, the concern that's there. Sure, we want, you know, serious crimes to be prosecutable, and we want penalties to be available for those who truly are evil doers and bad doers and would seek to, you know, be you know, anarchists in all of this stuff to the harm of the public interest and the public good, and for all those reasons that we have criminal law in the first place. You know, at the same time, I guess where I get a little uneasy in Trevor's characterization of it is, you know, he seems to be saying we need to take it a little bit easier on those who would test the boundaries or push the envelope. I forget exactly what he says, but, you know, just kind of, I think it was testing the boundaries, right? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? You know, the boundary has got to be somewhere in order for us to determine whether it's being tested. And in one person's boundary testing, you know, a member of Anonymous or 4chan or, you know, someone else, you know, their boundary may be different than, you know, somebody whose sensibilities are much more in line with traditional notions of justice and large corporate interest and government interest and all of that stuff. So, you know, it just gets so vague and gray and a little bit wishy-washy, very difficult to articulate how we're supposed to handle those who are going to test the boundaries, because it you know, by its very nature, tends to defy precise definition of what that really means. So, you know, I'm just am very, you know, I would urge us to be cautious in thinking about these things and not being too moved by exemplary sort of stories like Aaron Swartz, because I just know this for a fact from having dealt with clients who've been affected by violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. You know, I see it in real life. You know, there are for every person like Aaron Swartz doing what he's doing, we can all agree that he's not a hardened evil criminal wanting to bring down society as we know it. But he's out here, you know, doing this testing of the boundaries. You know, for everyone like him, there are scores of people who actually are nefarious, who are doing bad things, who do seek to do other people and enterprises harm, perhaps even just through the violation of terms of service. So I to hearken back to what you said, Denise, and I think you were using it in a slightly different context, we don't want to put the baby out with the bathwater, because there's a lot of bad stuff that goes on that the law still needs to provide a remedy for. And we don't want to soften things so much in the name of Aaron Swartz so that all of a sudden we're all victims and there's nothing else that can be done about it.
Marvin, Trevor's pitch, I think, to lawmakers and the public in his piece is that if we don't do something to allow youthful indiscretions and boundary pushing, we won't wind up with people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg, that, you know, that these titans of industry and economic engines for the United States will not have the opportunity to develop their careers and their thinking because they haven't been able to mess around sufficiently. Do you think that that's a persuasive argument for lawmakers?
I think it should be persuasive, and he's totally right. You know, mm-hmm. Shortly after Aaron died, several people said to me, God, I wonder what Aaron would have done. You know, I mean, he was 26. He'd done so many amazing things, you know, even as a teenager and a young man. what would Aaron have done with the rest of his life? And I think we all don't get the benefit of what Aaron, would have done. And Aaron's just one example. I noticed that on the Uber discussion, we all ended up agreeing. And I was looking for a place to disagree with someone, and Evan gave me a big target. I think Aaron's wrong about his discussion of the boundary. Right? When we're talking about criminal law and putting people in jail, in prison for a long time, this should be something that most of us agree is really, really wrong. These are the examples that he's pointing towards where a business might lose lots of money through hacking. It's an anti-hacking statute. Right? The law could be written so that we don't give prosecutors the discretion to make any of us a criminal for violating a terms of service. It could be written so that it more narrowly targets and more narrowly gives the power to prosecutors for those really bad actors. And one of the best articles of the week was Declan McCullough's article in CNET, where he walked us through how the CFAA had become bloated from 1983, the movie War Games, when the law was passed to protect federal computers and eventually banks, bank computers as well, to any computer and to the DOJ's interpretation of the law to say that you have unauthorized access to a computer if you violate the mere terms of service. Right? That means all of us are felons if we lie about our age or our height on OkCupid or Match.com. Right? The interpretation that terms of service violations alone are a federal felony takes contract law, which you would learn it in law school. Contract law, you don't even get punitive damages for. You just get damages to compensate the person for their loss in the contract, not even a punishment for the breach. We're taking contract law and going not only to punitive damages, but to criminal damages, simply for violating a contract that each of us click without even reading. So the terms of service interpretation, I think, goes far too broad. Even folks in government on the defense side will say the CFAA is an anti-hacking statute. There should be a technical hack going on. And when Trevor talks about tinkering at the edges, I think what we have to talk about is like real hacking. What Aaron did by spoofing his IP address in order to access documents that he was allowed to access as a Harvard researcher, that strikes me as not reaching the threshold and causing almost no harm. But that strikes me as something that should not be punishable under the criminal statute at all, let alone with prison penalties. So I think we should live in a world where things that are clearly causing major damage are what are illegal and criminally illegal, and that prosecutors don't have wide-ranging authority to prosecute people for contract violations, minor hacks that don't cause much damage, and in a world where I didn't mention this much, but where companies can't sue their employees merely for contract violations or for exceeding their authorization in the same way that, say, Bill Gates exceeded his authorization. So I think the CFA needs major reform along those lines and along the lines that Trevor has been talking about, that the coalition of innovators and advocates have been talking about. And I think Aaron is just the tip of the iceberg. He's not an exception in our criminal justice system at all. All of us are subject to the prosecutor's whims if we've ever lied about our age or birth date on Facebook.
Right. It would be really nice. Sure. In one second while I get this thought out before I forget it. It would be really nice. We've talked before on the show about how copyright reform could take the model of transportation safety and punish people more along the lines of writing a ticket for a minor infringement with small fines and fees, and you go on your way, you've gotten your slap on the wrist. It would certainly be nice if any sort of testing the boundaries type behavior had similar kinds of punishment associated with it, as opposed to the threat of prison time and terrible things that could ensue. Jerry, what were you going to say?
Oh, you took the words out of my mouth. I was going to echo what Marvin said about not having contract or terms of use be a predicate for a criminal. But even when you have hacking, which to get to Evan's point, real malicious, bad folks getting in there and hacking, they should be punished. Absolutely. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. It's just, what punishment do you enforce? I think the punishment should fit the crime, which means it should be proportionate. And so if it is, you know, a teenager that maliciously hacks the school's website and defaces it, well, what sort of harm does that cause? And so whatever punishment should fit that harm. It shouldn't be a mandatory minimum under federal sentencing guidelines, et cetera. That's what we should be looking at. Somebody who goes in and maliciously really causes millions of dollars worth of damage to a bank or whatever, well, sure, there should be a proportionate punishment for that as well.
One devil's advocate response that comes to me as we're talking about this is that so much of the sort of computer activity that society does not want to encourage goes undetected. That, you know, if you're really good at messing around with computer systems, you're going to be able to do it for a long time without getting caught, and you're going to be able to do some damage that may or may not be detected. You're going to be able to invade people's privacy. You're going to be able to make slaves out of people's computers, oftentimes without them knowing it. So one of the rejoinders, I guess, would be we need to make these laws stringent to be able to sufficiently deter the people who otherwise wouldn't get caught. But maybe having a strong law that can punish innocent people isn't the right solution to that. Marvin, what do you think?
So this is, it would be a cost-benefit analysis for each of us, is what you're
right.
saying.
Big stick. I'm going to come after you.
Okay.
With the shillelagh.
Yeah, exactly. So if there's a 1% chance of my getting caught, then I need this huge penalty out there in order for me to, in my mind, mathematically compute 1% times 10 years equals something I don't want to do. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are several problems with that. One, just as a matter of how people think, people don't tend to make that equation in their mind. They discount the likelihood of getting caught. They discount the likelihood of harm. And so it's not really a deterrent. It doesn't have the deterrent effect that you think it would have. And in addition to not deterring people as much as you think, it ends up making people think of the government as arbitrary and unjust. Arbitrary because it makes an example of and punishes certain people, perhaps because they just happened to be in an area where the prosecutor was aggressive, as Aaron Schwartz was, or perhaps because they happened to be well-known and the prosecutor can get a lot of press out of it, as Aaron was. Right? So it's completely arbitrary and discretionless and unjust because some people get these huge punishments and other people don't. You know, it would be like saying, why don't we send people to jail for double parking, you know, or death penalty for double parking? That would definitely cut down on double parking. But, you know, people would just stop enforcing that law or would ignore it, and the entire respect for law would go down. Instead, what you need to do is hire people who will go around and ticket people for double parking and give them commensurate penalties that look fair and just. And I think that would both deter the activity and have a higher respect for law.
Yeah,
and if
good
I could,
response.
As usual, jump in here.
Yeah. Please.
I'm sorry. So it's funny. I actually wrote an article for Reason.com right on this point. What you're describing is what's known as Beckerian punishment, right? This is Gary Becker, Nobel laureate in economics, made this case that the least likely it is to catch the person, the bigger the punishment should be. And it's funny that Eleanor Ostrom, who is a more recent Nobel laureate in economics, sort of makes a lot of the point that Marvin just made, which is what this does mm-hmm. is actually grow contempt for the system. And the way that you could sort of split the baby is half proportional punishment, but on a second, third, fourth offense, the punishment can be increased to very high levels. But once you were given that first warning, that first time, which still allows a Bill Gates or a Steve Jobs to get a warning and go on. But the mm-hmm. second, third time, now you're dealing with somebody who is really committed to being malicious, then it might be fine to really amp up that punishment, not just to deter them, but to deter society at large and signal that it's really the malicious behavior that we're going after.
Evan, I'm just glad we're able to have arguments that any Nobel laureate has ever come up with on the show. So I'm very proud of us today.
Yeah, what do you know of that?
Any final thoughts on this, Evan?
Oh, I disagree with a lot that's been said, but I guess the most fundamental one is that I don't see how making it a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act somehow puts the government in the place of the private transaction between parties to a contract. Because if you read the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, for a successful prosecution to take place, there not only has to be the unauthorized access and or access exceeding authorization, and that's really where the question of the binary question, has a terms of service been violated, yes or no? What the prosecution has to show in addition in order to successfully prove all the elements of the crime is that there was loss and or damage, depending on where you are, whether it's loss and damage or loss or damage. So it's just like the economic loss rule in contract law. You can't sue somebody for breach of contract and also sue them under a tort theory for the same set of damages. There's got to be something in addition to the breach of contract to give rise to tort liability. The same thing would hold true under a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violation. Yes, somebody may violate the terms of service. You might enter your wrong birth date on OkCupid. Fine. Okay. That's not going to get you prosecuted under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It's not going to get you convicted under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, because the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, is not going to be able, on those facts alone, show that you caused the requisite loss or damage. So I think it's a red herring for us to just focus on, oh, you could be put in jail for 100 years and, you know, your firstborn taken away just because you violated the terms of service. That's overstating it. And that's why I get kind of exercised about this. And it's why I get upset that people are clinging to the idea of Aaron Swartz as some kind of martyr here for a principle that, if we were to undo, would cause much more harm to the extent that it would leave unprosecuted the scores of folks who really do need to come within the scope of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for doing bad stuff. I'm all about Aaron Swartz and the good stuff he did, but it goes too far to make him the reason for rewriting the law. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I feel so sorry for babies in the context of our discussion here, because we've thrown them away. We've taken them away. We've thrown them out with the bathwater and we've split them. So we're going to make babies our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, just to throw a little love their way. And in a moment, we're going to talk about what the folks from DARPA have up their sleeve for us. Of course, they've brought us good things in the past. But before we get to that, we're going to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. Now, when you're done with all your boundary pushing, your messing about, your phone freaking, and timeshare computer hacking, and it's time to start your dream business, that's when you're going to want to go to LegalZoom.com. Because if you want to start a business, they make it really easy. You can incorporate your business or form an LLC at LegalZoom.com starting at $99. Forming your business the right way can save you money in taxes and ensure your personal assets are legally protected. LegalZoom can also help with trademarks, copyrights, patents, NDAs, and lots more. If you have a family, guess what? You need to make sure that they are protected too. You can protect your family and assets with a LegalZoom will for just $69, or establish a living trust. If you don't have a will, you leave it up to the government and courts to decide what happens to your family and your assets. That's never the best solution. So in the past 12 years, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom for LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more. It's really a wonderful place to go for any sort of easy, one-stop, few-page document kind of legal arrangement. Their online process guides guide you step-by-step through those arrangements, so it's easy to use and you get total customer support. If you have questions about filling out those documents, certain things that may apply in your jurisdiction, etc., any sort of nuances that you're concerned about, if you want to get that advice through LegalZoom, you can do that as well too. You can access an extensive network of attorneys through LegalZoom's legal plans in most states. You can search online profiles of those attorneys and unedited customer reviews to work with a LegalZoom plan attorney who's right for you and your business. So start your business and protect your family today at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm. You can get self-help services at your specific direction, or you can speak to a legal plan attorney and get your questions answered, and get ongoing advice. To receive a special thank you for using LegalZoom through TWIT, make sure you enter the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L, in the referral box at checkout. You'll get $10 off. So go to LegalZoom.com, enter the offer code TWIL. We thank LegalZoom for their support of This Week in Law. So over at DARPA and at the White House as well, which has put this up on their site, they're interested in figuring out ways to share spectrum. They're asking for proposals. They have a deadline here of April 9th to get submissions into them. Marvin, you put this in our rundown for today. Near as I can figure, what the government has in mind here is taking some of the spectrum that it has been allocated and figuring out ways to share it out with commercial enterprises. Am I getting close to the mark there?
You are. Exactly what's going on.
All right.
Can you see me or no? Because I'm having a little Skype issue.
We can see you.
Great. Fine. Okay. So what's going on here is nowadays, the way we communicate with one another relies considerably on wireless spectrum, the ability of things to communicate wirelessly. They send electromagnetic signals to one another. And without getting too technical, right, we can see part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's called color. Right? But everything below red is infrared. Everything above violet is ultraviolet. And we've parceled out throughout our communication structure a way of saying Verizon can communicate on blue and ABC can communicate on red, essentially that kind of equivalent. And the government, the U.S. government and the Defense Department, has huge ranges of essentially colors that they can use and no one else can use to communicate. For many years, we've been trying to figure out how to free up some of the spectrum that's being underused so we can use it for broadband and new technologies. And the two main areas there are TV broadcasters. So television broadcasters have all this spectrum, but no one watches TV over the air. People watch TV through cable or through satellite, and all of this great prime spectrum is being wasted essentially on people who aren't watching TV with bunny ears. And the second area that's completely underutilized, as some people argue, is government and defense spectrum. And there have been all these debates over what do we do? Do we clear off the defense spectrum, get the military to move to other bands and be more efficient? How do we do that? But the politics around that are so complicated. Military doesn't want to move. Government has to pay for them to move, clear them off, and then try to auction off the spectrum to pay down our debt. They get very little money for it. So now there's a new way of thinking. The U.S. government has said, why don't we figure out cool, innovative ways for lots of different folks to use the same exact spectrum. And this is actually a revolution. The idea that we're going to encourage, you know, the military and other government agencies to share spectrum with private companies that can use really, you know, high-tech radios, cognitive radios, different ways of sending information that far exceeds what we could do in the 1910s and 20s when we first structured our spectrum map. And so the DARPA proposal is a great proposal because we're trying to figure out ways to innovatively share spectrum. And this way, if everyone can share existing spectrum through technology, we don't have to go through the long bureaucratic process of convincing some agencies that don't want to move, that'll fight politically. They have to move, and when they move, to pay them and then to auction it off. We can probably get to a far faster resolution with great technologies if we can figure out a way to share the spectrum.
So who do you expect to be submitting proposals to DARPA, and what sort of things do you expect to see suggested?
So based on the last 10 or 15 years of debate on this issue, I would expect some MIT engineers, someone like David Reed has been a real thought leader on this issue. I also think there are some spectrum companies that have come out of nowhere, backed by sort of in this exact field. But you also have Google, Microsoft, Dell was a player. I think all of them will file to try to figure out ways to get access to that spectrum and share it because it's good for their businesses if more and more people use the internet and use wireless devices. And so I think you'll see, and you'll also see a lot of the open source community, the sort of activist-y community, folks at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute that have been working on unlicensed spectrum for a long time, and who create technologies of mesh wireless networks they're hoping to deploy in places like Detroit and Philadelphia or Libya and Egypt, right? These sort of mesh wireless networks that could also benefit from having access to spectrum in the U.S., say in Detroit and Philadelphia. So I think a lot of people will be trying to come up with new ideas.
All right, our tax dollars at work. Jerry, any ideas about what's going to happen with this?
Well, so I totally agree with Marvin that the political process to get spectrum out of the grips of the Defense Department and other federal agencies and put it to competitive use, for example, for broadband, is incredibly difficult. So this is interesting. This is sort of an alternative to do that. But I think it might be worth to go down the traditional route of getting the spectrum away from them and then to auction it off to buyers. And the reason is this, is why is it that it is Defense Department or TV broadcasters that today have the prime spectrum and so much of it? It's because the government gave it to them, right? In the 1920s, 30s, 40s, when the government was first handing out for free the spectrum, they gave it to what was the number one hottest killer app, new technology around, television. And it made perfect sense at that time. And they were given licenses that really were not tradable in the market, right? Today, a TV broadcaster can't just sell their TV license, their airwaves, can't just sell it to Verizon or AT&T or to a new entrant because that license is encumbered with all sorts of obligations about serving television. So what I'm afraid we might be doing today when we do something like sharing is that we might be encasing the hottest new technology today. And saying, okay, well, we're going to use sharing mesh networks. And then maybe we might be regretting that 50 years from now. If we take the extra effort and allow a market to happen, well, then the owners can put that spectrum to use in any number of ways. You can imagine them, some of them using it for mesh networking. You can imagine Google doing interesting things with it. You can imagine traditional carriers doing that. And whichever one wins out is going to win out. And the ones that don't, well, it will be incentivized to trade that spectrum for better and better uses. And you'll get the dynamism that happens for a market rather than just deciding this is where we're going to do it.
All right, Evan, any thoughts on freeing up government spectrum?
No, I mean, it just sounds like a good idea. And wouldn't it be great if DARPA can do something as great as, you know, some of the things that DARPA has done before in this mm-hmm. particular initiative here. So, you know, it could be, you know, the most exciting technologies and innovations could yet be ahead of us. I think we all hope for that. And, you know, maybe this is one of those ways, one of those means to arrive at that end.
All right. Well, I'm going to use my St. Patrick's Day bunny ears here to try and tune in our next story in the copyright arena. So Thingiverse is going to have some company, it appears. It's always fun to talk about 3D printing and the legal issues surrounding it. Thingiverse is a clearinghouse kind of site where you can go to get CAD designs and models to print things in 3D with 3D printers. There is a new company being formed by a gentleman called, he's actually a law student and Texas gunsmith, Cody Wilson, is forming something called DefCAD, which is going to be another such clearinghouse. But where Thingiverse has drawn its line on designs for weaponry or parts of weaponry, gunsmith and law student Cody Wilson wants those things to be freely available on his site and has also said that he's, to the extent that there's ever a DMCA takedown notice as to designs there, he's going to ignore them. You know, I guess way to get the both prosecutorial and regulatory attention on the world of 3D printing and designs. But again, that was just a matter of time. Evan, do you think that this is going to go anywhere?
No. I think this guy's right. I think this guy's a Actually, this guy's a gunsmith. I'm not going to diss him too bad. He might come and shoot me, right? He's a blowhard. You know, does he not understand that the DMCA there is to protect, this part of the DMCA, Section 512, is there to protect the intermediary as well. And he's, in the steps of the intermediary here. He's just inviting expensive litigation that I'm quite skeptical he has the means to defend. We won't be hearing much about this. Yeah, this will go the way of Bitcoin, in as much as we won't be talking about it very much.
Or maybe you'll pay for your CAD designs with Bitcoin over on DefCAD. That seems like a likely thing.
Let's all take acid and watch Alice in Wonderland together. We might as well live in reality about that much.
All right. Marvin, what do you think?
When I saw this article, I thought he was an interesting person. But I think he'd be better. He'd probably be better off trying to follow the laws than intentionally flouting them. I do think that the potential for 3D printing is vast. I think it's really fascinating, amazing development in our lifetime. And I think the companies that make it possible for us to share different designs are going to be really important companies in our lives. We'll think of them like Facebook and Google in the next few years. I think that he should aim for that market, which hasn't been cornered yet, rather than aiming for the Pirate Bay of 3D printing market. I think he's inviting very little, not much sympathy and a lot of scrutiny by choosing this business model. But, he could be the kind of person who pushes the boundaries without exceeding them. He seems to be deliberately flouting and exceeding them. He should embrace the DMCA. And what he should want, what I think every 3D printing software company should want, is for the, and I'll explain what the DMCA is in case I'm sure your readers, your listeners know, but under the DMCA, if you're YouTube and other people upload videos onto YouTube, you're not guilty as YouTube for the things uploaded by other people. Other people's copyright infringement doesn't punish YouTube as long as YouTube follows a DMCA notice and takedown procedure. Right? The copyright holder, let's say Pink, sends a letter to YouTube saying, this video uploaded by Marvin violates copyright, please take it down. If YouTube takes down the videos after the fact when they get notices, they're not liable for all of the copyright infringement by all of the Marvins out there. We want what the 3D printing world needs, I think, is to extend a DMCA-like protection, not only for copyright, but also for patent infringement and for trademark-type infringement when it comes to designs, et cetera. And so I think if we have a robust intermediary protection for all 3D printing-type companies across patent, trademark, and copyright, I think that's what he should really be aiming for, not what he's sort of done.
So, Jerry, you're in Washington, as is Marvin, and gun control is a very big topic in Washington right now, with efforts from the White House and Senator Feinstein to enact federal gun control law that would provide some consistency. But I'm guessing that none of those lawmakers have considered this issue, that while they're busy deciding how big magazines should be, they should also be considering what people can print out on their 3D printers, don't you think?
Well, so I do think some legislators have been thinking about this. I forget his name, but I know that there is one member from New Jersey, if I'm not mistaken, who has put out a bill or at least some draft language that would ban 3D printing of machine guns and other guns. And in his case, sort of the way he talks about it is that these are undetectable to metal detectors, the way 3D mm-hmm. printing works now. And that's the reasoning behind that. But I think what this shows with Cody Wilson and DefCAD is that this is going to happen and this is here to stay. And we are going to have to confront this. And I think, look, Thingiverse wants to have rules for its site where they're not going to allow these sorts of 3D objects to be downloadable. That's fine. It's fantastic. It's their site and it's their prerogative. And I think it's fine if Cody Wilson wants to have a site that does allow those. And whether we'd like it or not, the internet, given what it is, people are going to be able to find this. What baffles me is that he says he's going to ignore DMCA takedown notices for copyright infringing articles. That's just asking for trouble. You know, I think you can imagine a law that would ban the 3D printing of guns, but I don't see how that's enforced.
Yeah, it would be difficult. Let's move on, unless anyone else wants to talk about shooting them up with 3D printed weapons any further. Let's move on to some privacy stories. Jerry, you've been writing about drones over at Reason and thinking about some ways that drones could be used or are capable of being used that may not be the first things that come to people's minds. Can you expand on that for us?
Well, I mean, so what I was writing about is simply that with last week's filibuster by Senator Rand Paul, which brought a lot of attention to how the federal government is using drones militarily, and the possibility that they might be used domestically, either for law enforcement or for military purposes. So that brought a lot of attention to drones, and it's good attention that we needed to have on how our government is using this technology. But unfortunately, I think what ends up happening is that when you ask the average American, well, what do you think about drones? The first thing that comes to their mind is always going to be either state-sanctioned killing or surveillance. And while those are some uses of drones, there are actually so many other uses of drones, and there are fantastic uses of drones. So you can imagine all sorts of anything humans don't want to do because it's dirty or dangerous, right? So you can imagine sort of surveillance in a disaster situation where you want to get some recon. You might want to use a drone pipeline. Companies who want to inspect your pipelines around an area, they could do that.
Fukushima.
Fukushima
comes to mind.
Yep.
Yeah.
It turns out that agriculture and farming and ranching is a very big market for drone use because they can scan their land and their soil from the air. And by doing that, they know just the right amount of water and chemicals to use, which reduces the impact on the environment and improves their yield. So anyhow, there are any number. One example that I use a little bit facetiously, but it's totally within reach, is something called Tacocopter. You can imagine just like Uber, you can walk outside, press a button on your phone, and you could have a delivery of delicious tacos come to you, to your coordinates. And it sounds crazy, but there is a company that is doing this for remote areas in the developing world that use drones to deliver medicines and testing equipment to areas that are really, really remote.
Because I thought you were going to say they were delivering
tacos.
Delicious tacos.
not bad tasting tacos, but delicious.
Yeah. So, you know, the remote part. While we consider how we regulate drones, and you know, Congress passed a law that President Obama signed last year that requires the FAA to begin issuing regulations to incorporate domestic drones into the domestic airspace by 2015. So we are going to have drones in the U.S. airspace. We're going to be developing regulations. So as we do that, let's not go crazy, and because we're looking at how they're being used in other areas, militarily and law enforcement, and ban them outright or restrict what they can be used for.
Right, and just to give those of you playing along with the Twill drinking game here on Friday, getting into the afternoon in California elsewhere, we're going to talk about friend of the show, Ryan Calo, who has another good article on this topic at CNN with a picture showing, let's see, it is Todd Jacobs of NOAA using a drone to survey seals and sea lions in California's Channel Islands, which I can almost see from where I am, except not today. It's very foggy out there. So plenty of good uses for these. And Jerry, I hope we have your permission to call you Jerry Burrito in light of bringing Taco Copter to our attention. And we have to for sure make Taco Copter our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week
in
Law.
Is that hyphenated or is it one word?
I'm going to make it two words, a phrase, if you will. I'm not sure exactly how they do it for actually. It looks like Taco Copter is one word, at least in Jerry's piece.
You can go to tacocopter.com actually and see the site. It's actually
yours?
That's awesome. No, it's not. Flying robots deliver tacos to your location.
Oh yeah, it's that service you were talking about. I get it now. Yeah.
So it's fantastic. It it gets around all the taxi regulations. No parking issues.
Well, no, in all seriousness, this would get around food truck regulations. So if you think about it, local restaurants have gone to city councils and requested regulations of food trucks so that they can't park within X number of feet from their restaurants, et cetera. And again, this is just a barrier to competition. Something like a taco copter would allow entrepreneurs to come in and skirt those regulations.
All
and
right.
Denise, Virgil in IRC is suggesting to us that any lawsuit trying to stop this would be, you know, like a taco drone suit.
It would be a taco drone suit. But
stick with our show nomenclature here.
So, Evan, what do you think? I mean, there are so many, as Jerry has ably pointed out, and Ryan too, good uses of remote kinds of technologies with cameras. We tend to talk a lot about the scarier ones. Do you think that Washington, again, is going to be able to grasp the nuances and strike the right balance?
Well, again, this might be one of those reasons why we don't want technology-specific legislation. But drones, I guess, is a pretty broad range, sort, genus of technology here. We're so prejudiced against drones, at least most of us are at the beginning of the inquiry, because they come from the context of war. That's where most of us have heard about them. And so it's very easy to forget all of the very positive uses and effective uses that this technology can have and should have. And I certainly hope that the legislative responsibility is discharged appropriately and the regulatory responsibility is discharged appropriately, because sure, there's plenty of positive applications to this type of technology. So let's hope it's done well.
All right, Marvin, any thoughts on innovating with drones?
You know, it's hard for me to disagree with Ryan Kahlo. He's the person I go to as my drone expert. But I do think that it makes sense to put rules in place in advance. We can't simply say, you know, there are all these amazing things you can do with drones. I think Ryan hits the nail on the head that we shouldn't, you know, stop the drones, but we should stop the privacy violations. And so in his article, he says, I had predicted that drones would lead to a national discussion about privacy. The jury's out on that. And I do think that that's what I'm hoping will be forced by drones, that we have the privacy conversation finally today. Today in general.
Right.
I think that's right. I just hope we do it in a way where we have a trial and error process. And instead of trying to a priori try to figure out all the ways that we need to limit this technology, let's allow the existing torts, let's allow the existing processes to work. And when we see that something isn't working, well, maybe then we can go in and fix that rather than having one big rule ahead of time that might hamper the technology.
And Denise, I think that warrants two drinks. Not only was that Latin, but it was invoking Kant. So, two drinks for saying a priori.
True, definitely. So glad we could get everyone kicked off on their St. Paddy's Day weekend in good form. Let us move on. Marvin is a very well-respected and renowned someone who pays attention to the First Amendment. And we can't very well go through the show without having a good First Amendment-related story here. Another favorite of our topics is anyone up? and its creator, Hunter Moore, who has finally been hit with a defamation lawsuit. Evan, you want to tell us what's going on here?
Well, this was a case. I read the article about it. I haven't followed this really close. This was a case that Mark Randazza brought against Hunter Moore in Las Vegas. And essentially, Hunter Moore didn't show up. So there was a default judgment entered against him for $250,000. And, you know, we all know Hunter Moore, the creator, as you said, Denise, of Is Anyone Up, who, you know, has taken a kind of an outrageous antipathy, you might say, against people's you know, privacy and certainly their dignity in these, you know, self-taken shots, shared photos taken of themselves, posting on isanyoneup.com. You know, he sold the site last year to this anti-bullying thing. So yeah, it's satisfying to see this. You know, that that there has actually been definitive legal action successfully asserted. You know, who knows if this default judgment will hold up. It could still be vacated. But interesting to see Mark Randazza and his work in all of this. Mark definitely is a dynamic character. We've talked about him on the show. We ought to have him on the show, too, by the way. I hope we've invited him at some point because he's really doing a lot of interesting things out there. And it's interesting to see what he's doing here against this Hunter Moore character. So
if we haven't, we will. Good yeah, suggestion there.
For sure.
So Hunter Moore is not exactly the best poster child for the First Amendment, or is he, Marvin?
I mean, he's as good as anyone, right? The First Amendment should apply to all of us. And the people who tend to get in trouble shooting off their mouth, you know, are often not sympathetic. But I mean, here, you know, I don't know the case very well either, but we have built in protections for defamation. So defamation is you know, like slander or libel. You sue someone for tarnishing your reputation, and there are defenses for that, all these different built-in First Amendment defenses, one being New York Times v. Sullivan. So you'll get a case cite from 1964, you know, real triumph of the First Amendment, saying that if you're suing someone for defamation and you're a public figure, you have to really meet a very high standard. You have to prove the other person knew they were lying and wasn't negligent with the facts. They were actually deliberately lying or completely reckless. And so so this would probably meet a fairly high standard, the New York Times v. Sullivan standard. We also have other protections, which is basic. The truth is a defense. And so what's the name of the guy who runs Bullyville? What's his name?
James McGibney.
So if what McGibney said was true, then it would be a defense. If what Moore said was true, then it would be a defense. And then in addition, we, unlike a lot of other countries, only let you sue the person who actually did the defaming, not the social network on which the defamation happened, not Twitter, if that's where the defamation happened, not the IRC channel where the defamation happened. And that's so as an example of how the First Amendment works, he's as good as anyone because he defaulted on the and didn't show up. It's hard to analyze this exact case.
Right. And you know, who knows why you would enable a default judgment to be taken against you in something like this. You know, it's kind of a terrible, terrible decision because it can be enforced and it's going to be hard to set aside. Jerry, any thoughts on this?
No, I haven't really been following this case. I'm curious, though, I mean, maybe Marvin could tell us, when you have a truth as a defense, does that not open you to discovery that might be kind of crazy? I mean, what Moore is alleging here is that McGibney is a pedophile.
Right.
To prove that that is true, you can imagine Moore just reveling in the discovery that you would need to do that to prove that, even if it's not true.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Are there any protections for that, Marvin?
Well, so here there's actually a split between the US and the UK in terms of who bears the burden of proof and how high a threshold that is. I think it's telling that he took the default judgment instead of trying to prove it. It sounds like he was just making accusations, or at least it seems like he's a guy who just makes accusations from the way the TechDirt article was framed. But I don't know much about this case.
Jerry, you can bet your life that becomes problematic in litigation over this when truth is raised as a defense. And, you know, whether or not the court is ultimately going to allow that discovery to take place, you know, whether it's going to grant a motion for protective order or deny a motion to compel or something like that, you know, I know firsthand that, you know, parties love getting defendants love trying to take this discovery. And it can really have some interesting effects. This is certainly not a case that I'm working on, but I think it's really interesting how it can play out, you know, this question of truth being a defense. You know, there's some libel litigation going on against, I forget the names of the parties, but it was a case filed last year against, it was a climate scientist from Penn State, I believe, was felt like he was defamed because of some things he'd said about global warming, sued some bloggers. And so I find it really interesting in that case where if truth is a defense as to what he was saying about global warming, then kind of one of the issues in the case could be whether or not the science supporting global warming is true. You know, is that going to be one of the issues litigated? It reminds me of the Scopes monkey trial. You know, is Darwin's theory of evolution going to be the ultimate issue? You know, some scientific theory going to be the ultimate issue. So yeah, it can really make for some crazy and intriguing happenings in defamation litigation, this whole question of truth being a defense.
All right. Well, we've been talking about how technology can disrupt the taxi industry, the way your tacos are delivered. It also can disrupt the way that cases are litigated. You've written about that recently, Evan, and it relates to the social web. So tell us, how are we going to serve documents using Facebook?
Well, there was this case that came out this past week where the Federal Trade Commission was going after this outfit in India. And if you remember last year, there was some flurry on Ars Technica and other places talking about this industry where you know, folks would call up unsuspecting PC users saying, you know, we've been notified that there's something wrong with your computer. We need to get in and fix this problem. And so unwittingly, the user would grant access. So it was this whole scam going on. The FTC took some action against that, against some guys and a couple of companies that were based in India. And they were able to serve the complaint and the summons through ordinary means. You know, there was some difficulty, you know, like the Hague Convention on the Service of Process and all that stuff. It's just this, you know, kind of a arcane process to serve a complaint and summons on someone overseas. So the Federal Trade Commission realized that if they were going to have to really abide by all the rules of service for all the other, you know, the subsequent documents in the litigation, you know, the notices, the pleadings, the motions and all that stuff, it might really make the litigation more difficult. So they filed this motion for leave under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that allowed them, asking the court to allow them for, you know, to serve the documents through alternative means. And what the FTC requested was the permission from the court to serve all the papers in the litigation on these defendants in India using email and also Facebook to give notice and to serve these documents. And the court found that given these circumstances, it was fine for the FTC to be able to do that. And, you know, what we can extrapolate from that is even though this was the federal government as the plaintiff here, this was a civil case. That wasn't a criminal matter, even though the federal government was on the side of the, you know, quote unquote prosecuting party here. We could assume that any civil plaintiff or any civil litigant really could, if it shows certain things, be granted leave to serve documents in these new and innovative ways. And what I enjoyed the court saying, you know, the court kind of went into some interesting discussion about, in general, how willing the judicial system should be in adopting and or at least embracing new technologies. And it was saying that it says that courts, I'm trying to look for the precise languages here, is courts must be open to considering requests to authorize service via technical means of then recent vintage rather than dismissing them out of hand as novel. And it's cited to, I liked that terminology, you know, of then recent vintage. You know, it just seems kind of like has a really neat multi-perspective view of time and relativism and all that stuff. If you kind of parse it. You know, it's cited to a case from 1980 where a plaintiff could serve some documents on some folks in Iran using telex. You know, there's some then recent vintage for you. And, you know, there's a fairly robust body of case law that just talks about service of process by email. There's a fairly oft-cited Ninth Circuit case called Real Properties from 2002 that talks about service of process and service of documents by email. And so what we have here is, you know, the court said that, yeah, we are also requiring all these, the service to be made by email, but this and so that email served as a backstop in the event that it didn't, that service didn't get through using Facebook. The FTC showed that these people are actually on Facebook, and it, you know, they cross-referenced it with the email addresses. So it's an interesting little case here to see how Facebook, as a means for communication of important information, is validated by the court overseeing this this litigation.
Well, of course, anytime you put something on the internet, you're simply just making it available there. And what the service of process statutes are concerned about is notice. Did they talk at all about how the party being served by Facebook was to get notice that the documents were there? Were they going to get tagged?
No, it was through the messaging feature of okay. Facebook. You know, so they ostensibly would have been, you know, private communications, you know, in as much as we can expect privacy in this stuff. So yeah, it wasn't posting it, you know, on somebody's wall or, you know, mm-hmm. you know, leaving a comment on a page or something like that. It was, you know, delivering it through the message delivery infrastructure that Facebook affords.
Got it. All right. Well, let us move on to our tip and resource of the week. Our tip is from the EFF. There's a good article over there about opting out of receiving Facebook ads based on your real life shopping activity. This is by Rainey Reitman. And this is in response to Facebook's announcement that it's teaming up with large data brokers to enhance the ad experience. And the idea is you're going to be served up ads based on your actual shopping habits. So this goes hand in hand with, you know, you go to, I forget, there was a story in the news a couple of weeks ago about a young woman who was shopping for baby items at Target. She was pregnant, but her parents didn't know about it until they started receiving mail targeted to her shopping behavior. And the cat was out of the bag. There are general tips over there at EFF, installing an add-on to protect your privacy online, avoiding giving your phone number and email address to companies when possible, and various opt-out instructions that are in more detail. So if you are concerned about this, do check out Rainey Reitman's article to opt out of targeted advertising based on your actual shopping activity. Our resources of the week are manifold. We have just a plethora of them this week because we have the two wonderful guests we've had today who are both authors. I alluded to the fact that Marvin thinks a lot about the First Amendment. His book on internet freedom goes deep on that subject. And really, as you said in your podcast with Jerry, Marvin, it talks about viewing the world through a First Amendment lens. So I think that that is a really worthwhile thing to check out. On Internet Freedom is available over there at Amazon. And Jerry's podcast is called Surprisingly Free. And the two of you had a big, long talk about this. Was it just last week, Marvin?
It was. It was my first radio interview about the book, and I have another one coming up. But yeah, we delved deeply into the First Amendment in the podcast. And in some ways, the podcast was more academic than the book. Even the book is written for a very general audience. It's been great to see the kind of reception it's got from folks who never even think about the law or who aren't lawyers or technologists. But it was also really fun to delve deep into complex First Amendment questions with Jerry just last week.
Great. So check out the book on internet freedom. And then Jerry is a contributor to a book called Copyright Unbalanced. Jerry, can you tell us about, is it a chapter that you've submitted there?
So I'm the editor of the book, and I also have a chapter. But the other chapters include chapters by Timothy Lee from Ars Technica, Rehan Salam from National Review, Tom Bell, lots of great copyright thinkers and scholars. And what the book is, basically, it's a free market case for copyright reform, right? We like copyright, we like property rights, but we think that the current system that we have is out of control, and it's an out-of-control regulatory regime that really impinges on our traditional property rights. And we think it could be pared back and make it look a lot closer to what the founders had in mind when they put the copyright clause in the Constitution and when they enacted the first Copyright Act. Right? If you think back, the first Copyright Act, which they themselves wrote, was very, very limited. And what we have now is so far away from that. So, again, yeah, this is the free market case for copyright reform.
Great. It sounds like if you do an update, you should have Derek Khanna contribute as well.
Yeah, it's really funny because right at the time that we were publishing this, Khanna released that memo, and that all happened. And since then, yeah, he's been a booster of this book. So, yeah, it's really funny how, and again, this is really an issue for conservatives and libertarians, and in particular for the Republican Party. It's an opportunity for them to take and run with it. If you think about it, the Democratic Party tends to be the ones who, if you look at SOPA, for example, it was the Republican candidates at the time there was a primary for president, and members of Congress from the Republican Party who jumped ship on SOPA and began to oppose it. Who stayed with SOPA till the very bitter end? Well, it was Al Franken and lots of other Democrats who have ties to Hollywood and the music industry. So, Rehan Salam and Patrick Ruffini in the book make the case that this is copyright reform is an issue for a Republican Party that is looking to sort of reinvent itself and attract younger voters as well.
Yes, we mentioned last week, Glenn Reynolds wrote a great piece on how the Republican Party can make itself cool if it just embraces this issue. So we're hoping for that. They need some help in that regard. All right. Our final resource is for folks either in California, because it's going to take place at Stanford, or particularly interested in how technology is going to change the landscape of the legal profession through things like service by Facebook and others. On April 26th, there is a Codex Future Law 2013 conference happening at the Stanford Center for Legal Informatics. That looks really interesting. It's going to bring together leading thinkers, entrepreneurs, investors, and technologists experimenting and actively working to re-architect the future of law. So that would be the place to be if you think about those kinds of issues. That'd be really fun to attend, don't you think, Evan?
Yes, definitely. It was so thrilling to think about attending that my hand froze and I couldn't take the microphone off of mute. So yeah, it looks good. I mean, so many of these events happen out there in your neck of the woods, or at least your relative neck of the woods. Yes. And it's up the road from you. But yeah, this looks like definitely one I would attend if I were there.
All right. So it caught my eye, and folks should check it out if you're interested in how law will be practiced in the future. And with that, we'll go ahead and thank our wonderful panel for today. Marvin Amori of the On Internet Freedom book. Go out and get it right now. Anything else, Marvin, you want to share with our listeners and viewers before we sign off?
Sure. There was a moment early in our talk where I kind of lost you on Skype, exactly when I wanted to respond to Evan. And I think Evan was talking about the CFAA, and I just want to explain one point.
Sure.
Under the CFAA, he's right that you need to cause damage, $5,000 worth of damage, to be sued civilly by a corporation. And that's he has a point there. But on the criminal side, from everything I understand and from talking with experts, you don't need to, you can simply lie about your age on OkCupid. And so to some extent, we are all at the whim of prosecutors. It's not actually concern that Oracle will sue us, but it is a concern that a rogue prosecutor can go after you without damages. And on the flip side, when Aaron downloaded millions of documents that he had access to that were academic articles, the prosecutor claimed that that caused millions of dollars worth of damage, which if anyone who's ever paid for an academic article knows, kind of unlikely. So there is actually a real concern on the prosecutor side of the CFAA. So I just wanted to sort of specify that, as I was lost at that exact moment, that I wanted to sort of clarify the difference there.
Thank you. And we've really enjoyed your insights and thoughts today. It's been great having you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Marvin is Amori, A-M-M-O-R-I, on Twitter. And Jerry's over on the Twitter too. He's Jerry Brito there. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us again.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And I have not yet checked out your book, but I'm looking forward to reading Copyright Unbalanced.
Thank you.
And it reminds me too, we had Tim Sandifer on the show a while back, and I'm glancing up, reminding myself that I read his book back when he came on. It's called The Right to Earn a Living. And he has a lot on the taxi issues we discussed at the top of the show. So if anyone is interested in going deeper on that, check out Tim's book as well. Evan, I'm so excited that we get to talk to all these smart people every week.
It's a lot of fun, isn't it? Yeah, this has been a really interesting conversation. Marvin, really fun talking with you. Nice to meet you. And Jerry, Jerry, great to talk with you again. So many intriguing and very provocative and compelling topics. And so, yeah, it's a real pleasure to speak with you. And Denise, always good talking with you. And, see you next week, I guess.
And you and everyone have a very safe St. Patrick's Day weekend. Call Uber if you need a ride. And if you'd like to check out all the stories that we've been discussing today on the show, you can find them at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/202 is our episode today. If you're not listening with us live, you should if you can. We record every Friday at 11 Pacific, 1800 UTC. But if you can't, you can always find the archive of our shows at twit.tv/twill, going very back to episode 1. We're also on iTunes and YouTube. And pretty much everywhere you like to find this kind of entertainment, you're going to find us there. So we're very thrilled that you've joined us today. We hope that you will join us next week on Friday the 22nd, I believe is our next show. We look forward to seeing you then. And until then, be careful this weekend and always take care.